I am here with Matthew Iglesias. Matt, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So how would you describe your journalistic and political background before we jump into the deep end of the pool of Democratic politics?
Sure. I started writing a blog sort of in my spare time when I was a college student around 2001, 2002. Graduated, worked for a kind of a small progressive magazine here in D.C. called The American Prospect for a number of years. I've been doing different things, but mostly, you know, kind of digital journalism from Washington, D.C., writing about politics. I was working at Vox.com. I left there a little bit more than 4 years ago, go off on my own, start a Substack. Like a lot of people, I think I felt a little pushed out of the currents in progressive politics that had been churning in the late teens, circa 2020. Been doing my own thing since then. Consider myself liberal, left or center, a Democrat. I voted for Kamala Harris. But, you know, with a kind of increasing unease about where things had gone and sad that Donald Trump won the election, but I also hope this can be an opportunity to kind of set things aright, do some course corrections in left of center politics.
Yeah. So you and I are in a similar spot politically. Perhaps there's some mm-hmm. daylight between us, which we can explore. But how would you say the Democrats have lost their way if you had to summarize the destroyed fortunes of the Democrats politically in this last cycle? What would you give as the primary reasons?
I mean, there's you know, you lose your way in many ways simultaneously. I think primarily Democrats have gotten sort of out of touch with kind of mainstream cultural and moral values that people have. You know, I have some of my own criticisms. There are ways in which I myself am a little out of touch with mainstream cultural moral values. But, you know, you really saw a party that has gotten so invested in certain kinds of identity politics and, you know, slightly loopy ideas about people and democracy in ways that I think don't really work and have lost or sort of buried the core of what it is that people like about the idea of a political party that cares about, you know, protecting vulnerable people and making sure that we're all taken care of, has gone into this kind of hyper-focus on the idea of a kind of a, you know, escalator of privilege and oppression in a way that has, you know, distorted the kind of basic epistemological soundness of how progressives think and talk.
So let's talk about identity politics, because have you migrated at all in your view of this issue? Because you and I have never spoken before, mm-hmm. but I dimly remember you making some fairly woke noises when I had my falling out with your colleague Ezra Klein back in, I think it was 2018. Are you in the same spot you were in there, or am I misrecalling what actually happened there?
No, I mean, I think you're correct. I mean, I have shifted my view quite a bit about what the balance of risks are in our society. You know, I think that when that went down in 2018, it seemed to me that, you know, all this stuff about political correctness, et cetera, was being really kind of badly overblown. And I think that was wrong, you know, that what we really saw over the next few years is that there was a real challenge among Democrats in kind of articulating, you know, basic approaches to crime problems, police brutality, other things that came up over the past, over the next several years. And, you know, I was on the wrong side of that. And I think more and more people have been catching up to the fact that, you know, we let things get too far.
So actually it's in the news now. I mean, I think it's probably still in the news. I just happened to read a Nation article on this topic that I found especially galling. There's this story of the Daniel Penny, Jordan Neely incident on the subway car in New York. Penny, as many people remember, was acquitted of murder charges and even manslaughter charges. And he was found not guilty of whatever Alvin Bragg threw at him. Yet it's still being covered, it seems to me, in left-wing politics and media in ways that seem morally deranged and don't suggest that the Democratic Party is going to learn the lessons or it's guaranteed to learn the lessons that I think you and I agree that it should learn, right? So this Nation article kind of lined up the case of Daniel Penny and Luigi Mangione. I don't know if you read this article, but it made them seem essentially as equivalent cases of vigilante justice or pseudo justice that were both monstrous acts of violence that are being celebrated by, in one case, the far left, in one case, the far right. And if anything, according to this author of the Nation article, the Penny case where you had somebody, to my eye, actually just simply trying to defend innocent bystanders from the rampages of a violent lunatic, you had what was optically judged to be the worst or least sympathetic case, which is to say that the writer of this article thought that his readers at the Nation would find Luigi Mangione, the person who murdered more or less randomly selected healthcare CEO, would seem more sympathetic than Daniel Penny, who, you know, by the lights of this author, had effectively lynched a homeless black man on a subway car. How do you view that case? And are you as baffled by some of the left-leaning intuitions you've heard about it as I am?
Yeah, I mean, the Penny case is interesting because I think this is a little bit of a lagging indicator, you know, of the politics from a previous time when the indictment originally came down. I, you know, never looked into this in extreme detail. He was acquitted. It seemed like it was not that close of a call among the jury in a very liberal city. I think you've got to believe that, you know, there was no case, right? There's no strong case against him. And that if anything, you know, the racial politics on this probably went in the opposite direction of the one that I've seen some leftist people suggesting. You know, I think an African-American Marine who stepped up to defend other people on a subway would have been given the benefit of the doubt by left-wing people. But instead, a white seen as conservative one was viewed with incredible suspicion. So, you know, I think the coverage of that case that I've seen since the verdict in some of the further left sources, some of the Twitter feeds of left-wing politicians has been pretty thoughtless and pretty bad. At the same time, if you compare the reaction to what it would have been 4 or 5 years ago, it's much more muted. You know, The Nation has always been a far left publication. When I was, you know, very enthusiastically voting for Barack Obama in 2008, 2012, they were saying, oh, he's way too moderate. You know, we're much more left wing than that. So, you know, I don't think it's surprising to see ideas in The Nation that I think are too far left. I don't think it's so surprising that a handful of politicians in New York City are fired up about this. When Penny was first arrested, you know, there were big protests in New York demanding that this happen. When he was acquitted, much more muted response. I mean, I think that the country has moved to the right in a number of ways, Donald Trump winning the election, sort of most notable of them, but that we are seeing not an evaporation of kind of out of control left-wing or woke ideas, but a recession of them back more to, you know, the kind of normal level that it's historically been at. But I did think that this case was a good example of, you know, racial politics on the left getting a little bit out of control. You know, you can't expect people to ride on mass transit if there's going to be mentally disturbed people acting out and threatening people. I think that's sort of common sense. It's something that transit officials around the country have started to recognize. And it's good if bystanders come in and intervene and try to help people. It's, of course, tragic if when they do that, somebody ends up being seriously hurt or even killed in this case. But that just goes to show, you know, that we need to think more seriously about how we treat people with severe mental illness. The man who unfortunately died in this case, as I understand it, had been arrested many, many times, had been offered all different kinds of mental health support and treatment. But, you know, we've really moved away from being able to coercively treat people who are a danger to themselves and to others. And that's a real problem, I think, in our society. You can't just treat, you know, the public space as a kind of, you know, open venue for disorder and chaos.
Mm. I have a heuristic in my mind that I would want the Democrats to absorb. I'm wondering if this goes too far for you, but it seems to me that any reference to race most of the time, virtually all of the time, is politically and even ethically suspect at this point, right? So I think we should be very, very slow to talk about, think about, reference, point to be motivated by the concept of race in our politics and really in our ethics. I mean, there are certain cases where I think you could defend it, and you know, perhaps those could readily spring to mind. But generally speaking, you know, 99% of the time, it seems to me to be the wrong direction to move. And politically, I think this is now obvious, but I think I could make the ethical case for that. Does that seem like it's overreaching to you?
Well, I mean, it depends what we're talking about, right? I mean, I read a book recently about prison gangs. And obviously, I think if you want to understand how prisons function, the fact that many of them are sort of de facto controlled by these racially segregated gangs is very salient. It's very relevant. You can't speak intelligently about that without talking about race. At the same time, I mean, I really do think that what we want to do as humanists, as liberals in the sort of broad philosophical sense, is reduce the salience of race in our society, right? Is not inject it into contexts where it's ambiguous or, you know, debatably relevant. And I think that a trend really emerged around 5 to 10 years ago of doing the opposite, right? Of sort of taking situations and finding opportunities to inject a racial discourse into them. And there was a view that that was going to help us make some kind of progress as a society. And I think that's really wrong. I mean, it's wrong. It's wrong as an electoral politics question, but it's wrong as a question of human psychology and interaction, right? We don't want to be encouraging people to think in terms of racial and ethnic categories. That's sort of contrary to the American value ethic historically. Obviously, we have had a lot of people in American history who do encourage people to think in terms of racial categories. But classically, what you would say is, well, those people are racists, right? They're doing something bad by saying we need to be thinking about race all the time. We need to be thinking about racial categorizations all the time. And we should be moving away from that. You know, I have one of my grandparents is from Cuba. And so, you know, a question arises in the scheme of, you know, American ethnicity. Does that mean I'm in some sense, am I a Hispanic person, quote unquote? And, you know, I think in most real world senses, it's like, no, you know, I have light skin. I only speak English. I was raised in a Jewish household.
Your Latinx? Did you get the memo?
At the same time, you know, it's a true fact about my family, my ancestry, et cetera. But, you know, there's no fact of the matter about these kind of schemes and categorizations where people, we have family members who are from different places, we have ancestries, but it's not healthy to encourage this kind of, you know, obsessive thinking about race and ethnicity.
Yeah, well, the painful irony for me, and this is something that I've whinged about, I think, for several years at this point, is that the Democrats, you know, up until yesterday, thought about race, spoke about race every bit as much as white supremacists on the right. I mean, you have to go all the way to the neo-Nazis to find people on the right who are as vocal about the salience of race and racial difference. And that just seems patently crazy to me. I mean, what's wrong with identity politics, in my view, you know, there are many ways you could come at this, but it's, I mean, to come back to the Daniel Penny, Jordan Neely case and perhaps make it generic. I mean, if you described a situation on a subway car where there was a violently deranged and threatening person who came on the car and terrified everyone, you know, including women and children, and a man at some risk to himself and at some obvious risk of future prosecution stood up to try to pacify this person and attempted to use the minimal amount of force, but because of his, you know, lack of perfect skill, wound up severely injuring or even killing the aggressor. If you describe that situation generically to people left of center, as you move further left, and you don't actually have to move that far left, I mean, really just a step left of center, I think you meet people reliably who don't know how they feel about that situation, no matter how exhaustively you describe it and you describe the motives of people involved and the testimony of bystanders, et cetera. They don't know how they feel about it until you tell them the skin colors of the people involved, right? And if you swap the skin colors on the various participants, they feel differently, reliably differently. If you tell them that the victims are Jewish, they feel one way. If you tell them that they're Black, they feel another way. All of these markers of identity are incredibly salient for them morally. And that, to my eye, is the very definition of not actually thinking these things through in moral or ethical terms, right? It's just, it is a layer of political delirium that is riding atop of our, you know, otherwise serviceable moral toolkit and visibly, palpably damaging it. So what I think we need in the Democratic Party to reboot, and we're going to come to your list mm-hmm. of, I think, 9 principles that you wrote about on your blog, Slow Boring, which seemed to have been quite influential. But I think that, you know, one place to reboot from is just a call for kind of basic moral sanity and honesty, right? I mean, and if changing skin color in a situation changes your intuitions as reliably as it does for a white supremacist, the onus is on you to make moral sense of that.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that what happens in the identity politics space on the left is people have taken a, you know, I would say a widespread moral failing, right, which is to judge cases in part based on the identity of the people involved and your kind of group affiliations and turn it into a kind of a virtue. And I don't know, you know, I think there's probably a lot of people whose snap judgments of a situation might be influenced by information about the ethnicity of the people involved. But what's become very unusual on the left in America is for people to say that that's good, right? To say like that's true and correct. And in a more abstract policy sense, I think there's been a move to, you know, a lot of disparate impact type logic. I mean, a kind of circular argument that I've seen play out in DC where I live, but in a lot of other cities is, you know, there's been a move in cities to have cameras, you know, to catch cars who are speeding. Right. And then in DC and Chicago and a number of other cities, once these were installed, it's come out, well, you know, they're catching more people speeding in Black neighborhoods. And so that's bad, right? Somehow the cameras are discriminating or something. And you think that through and it's like, well, by definition, right, we've put cameras in place precisely because cameras aren't subject to these kind of biases. Mm-hmm. If people are speeding more in African-American neighborhoods, that could be a disproportionate benefit to the pedestrians living in those neighborhoods, right? I mean, if people are driving unsafely by your house, by your kid's school, that's really bad, right? You have learned something about the world from that. And it also, it doesn't matter, right? I mean, there's, you know, cities should set speed limits appropriately. It shouldn't be too low. The fine shouldn't be too high, whatever it is. But if you have reasonable traffic rules, then you should try to enforce them and get people to drive safely. And this kind of endless inquiry about the identities of people involved or trying to draw inferences or trying to draw obvious conclusions about what's right and what's wrong based on those kind of things, it doesn't make sense. It's not something that you find, you know, if you look at the kind of the great reference points that even progressive-minded people look to, say, you know, who were our moral leaders in the past? Who are our political heroes? That's not how they talked. It's not how they acted. You know, these are ideas and habits of thought that have arisen relatively recently, I think, out of a kind of slightly odd academic milieu that I don't totally understand. It's not, you know, I was a philosophy major when I was in college and, you know, read political moral theorists, et cetera. None of the people I was assigned said that you should proceed on that kind of basis. Mm-hmm.
You didn't get to that chapter in Rawls where it said—
Right. Right. I mean, you know, it's not Rawls. It's not Mill. It's not part of the liberal tradition. It's not part of the Marxist tradition even. I don't know 100% what it is, but it's become very, very dominant and especially became ultra dominant about 5 years ago. And, you know, it's something, I mean, this is part of what I wrote in my piece, but I mean, it's something that the Democrats really desperately need to move away from back to, you know, an ideal of treating people as individuals and judging them based on what they do. You know, we can talk about the history of America, right? In which obviously racial categorizations were a very important part of American history for a long time. That's like a real fact. We don't need to lie to people about that, but it's not something that we should encourage on a forward-looking basis.
Well, why isn't wealth inequality as a focus an appropriate surrogate for rectifying the disparities as people that have obviously a historical explanation that people are still worried about. I mean, if it is in fact true, and last I looked, it seemed to be true, although these data are a few years old, that on average, African-American families have 1/8 the amount of familial wealth as white families. And that's a disparity which might have, you know, several reasons, but the most glaring certainly is the history of racism and racial discrimination and racist policies in America, right? I mean, that has a legacy effect that would seem undeniable. But whatever the reasons, it is the current reality. And if you just focused on class, if you focused on disparities in wealth and all of the opportunities that correlate with wealth, you know, educational opportunities, et cetera, health outcomes. If you focus on those things in a way that was race blind, you would obviously disproportionately advantage or appropriately and proportionately advantage, depending on how you thought about it, people of color without ever stepping into onto this terrain of politically invidious and, you know, morally suspect distinctions, which, you know, of the sort that we saw during COVID, where you have, you know, the Biden administration saying that we're going to privilege Black and brown people for the vaccine because that's obviously the good thing to do, or we're going to give, you know, aid to Black, you know, businesses run by Black and brown Americans before white Americans, because that's obviously a step in the direction of equity. I mean, that, you know, it's understandable that, I mean, the good intentions at the bottom of all that are recognizable, but it is understandable that is, you know, just akin to just obvious political evil when viewed from the perspective of a desperately poor white American who you know, it should be just as much within the circle of our social concern as any other poor person.
Yeah, I mean, you know, something I like to tell people, remind people of, is when Barack Obama was president, you know, early in his term, he was trying to do a big healthcare bill that, you know, among other things, it expanded Medicaid, it gave extra money to low-income people to help take care of their health needs. And Rush Limbaugh, you know, conservative radio host, very influential guy while he was alive, he used to say, oh, this Obamacare, this is really a reparations program, right? Because that was, he was trying to sink an effort to help poor people by making it out to be just an effort to help Black people, right? He was trying to mobilize, you know, racial division to defeat an egalitarian economic program. That's a very classic trope in American politics. And if you go back, Martin Luther King's book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community? He talks about how, you know, the only way we are going to develop what he wanted for Black people, you know, living in slums, living in ghetto neighborhoods, was to build an alliance with lower income white people who had similar needs. And in the Freedom Budget that he and Bayard Rustin and Philip Randolph put together, you know, they say, we're going to have quality education when we have good schools for everyone. We're going to have good jobs for everyone, right? That's sort of how you try to create a politically tractable vision, is you decrease these kind of racial divisions. And, you know, it's obviously politically toxic. I remember in the summer of 2020, I was in rural Maine, you know, and there's a kind of affluent town by the coast, and they had all the Black Lives Matter, you know, banners up there. And then there's a poorer town inland, you know, people living in trailers, things like that, all white in both cases, very white state. You know, and obviously, you know, if you're living in a trailer in Penobscot, Maine, and the lumber industry that your family used to work in has gone away, things like that, I mean, you don't want to be lectured by other people about how privileged you are in life. And I think that's just completely obvious. It also does a disservice, actually, to William Julius Wilson talked about the truly disadvantaged, by which he meant, you know, poor Black people living in, you know, high poverty neighborhoods, right? Really cut off from economic opportunity and kind of functional social institutions. You do no favors to people in that kind of situation to kind of hyper focus on, you know, microaggressions or kind of pure representational politics among the elite. Because, you know, the only people able to take advantage of those kind of opportunities are actually people who have achieved a fair amount of prosperity, right? So if you want to help people who are really suffering, which I think you should, you know, you need to focus on kind of objective indicators of deprivation, whether that's income, wealth, health status, other kinds of things like that. That's common sense politics. That's the way it was done by almost everybody up until, you know, the 20-teens. And it's been a dead end. And I think that should be the message of the extent to which all kinds of people swung toward Trump this time around.
I want to jump into your nine principles, and this will take us over some of the ground we've already covered, perhaps, but in greater detail. But before we jump into your nine principles, I'm wondering, what do you think Biden's legacy will be at this point?
You know, I mean, I think it's going to be quite meager. His whole pitch was that he was going to sort of save the country from Trump, to go out the way that he did, to be succeeded literally by Trump, you know, means there essentially is no legacy, except that we don't know what's going to become of Trump, right? I mean,
right.
If he turns out to be as threatening to American institutions as I'm certainly concerned he might be, that could leave Biden with a very bleak legacy. If 4 years of Trump goes okay in America, you know, then he'll be a kind of a funny trivia answer, right? Mm-hmm. Like Benjamin Harrison, who served between two Grover Cleveland terms. And that's because, you know, who even remembers Grover Cleveland, right? So Biden may just not amount to anything when he, I think, actually had a lot of promise, you know, in 2020. He had some appealing ideas, I think. And I think that the vision of kind of a figure from an older generation who was going to try to bring Democrats back to stability is why he won the primary, you know, in a very kind of tumultuous time. He was seen by rank and file Democrats as a steady pair of hands who was going to, you know, both beat Trump, but also bring the party back to a set of values that, frankly, Biden had been associated with for most of his career. And then that's not how he governed. And I'm quite taken aback by it and have been consistently for the past several years.
And what do you actually expect of a second Trump term at this point?
I mean, it's very hard to say. You know, I mean, everything that you get from Trump is very contrary signals all the time. You know, he campaigns the whole time. He says, we're going to have tariffs on everybody. And then his allies in the business community say, no, don't worry. He's not really going to do that. There was a Wall Street Journal article this morning which said, nope, like he is going to do that. There was this kind of, I think, slightly unnerving story about ABC settling a defamation case mm-hmm. with Trump that I think, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but most people who are informed about these things say they think ABC could have won that case if they'd taken it to court, almost certainly would have won. But, you know, they wanted to settle it because the Walt Disney Company didn't want to make Trump angry, didn't want to make him upset.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to put in an FBI director who says he's going to like purge the institution and find Trump's enemies. So, I mean, who knows? You know, it's if there's anything that I know from 20 something years of covering politics, it's that it is very hard to predict the future. I hope it goes okay. You know, not all of his ideas are terrible. I think people had some valid reasons to want to vote for him. I think it's unfortunate that Republicans threw up somebody with really a kind of a low character. You know, nobody has ever said to me about Donald Trump, well, if you really knew him, you know, if you saw what he was like behind closed doors, he's so much more thoughtful. He's so much kinder than he comes across as. And you hear that every other president. Mm. You know, maybe it's BS, but like people who worked for George W. Bush, people who worked for Biden, people who worked, you know, people who lost, Mitt Romney, Hillary Clinton, their closest aides will say, you know, this person is so great. I talk to people who worked for Trump in his first term and they'll say, you know, no, like this guy's totally nuts. It's exactly what it seems like. And that, you know, that worries me.
Do you think Trumpism and the more generically this trend of right-wing populism in America ends or gets severely mitigated in the absence of Trump? I mean, is Trump a singular figure that has potentiated this cult of personality that has subsumed the Republican Party? Do we swing back to a more normal Republican Party after Trump or not necessarily?
You know, there's an element of personalistic politics to Trump that's very unusual and that I think is going to be hard for anybody else to replicate. There's also an idea, though, of a kind of a crude nationalism to Trump that I think has kind of deep roots and that you see in a lot of different countries and a lot of different contexts that I don't like. You know, I don't think it's morally admirable to be saying things like, we should have taken the oil, that kind of thing. I don't think mm-hmm. that, you know, there's very legitimate criticisms of how immigration policy was handled under Joe Biden. I also don't think that trying to promote, you know, indifference to people because of they were born in another country is like a good thing. This is a form of identity politics that I think, you know, can be quite problematic, but that also is kind of deep in the structure of democratic politics and isn't going to be vanishing. I thought that if Trump had lost, you know, that the spell would kind of break right. on this, that Republicans would say, you know what, like, this guy had some good points, but fundamentally he's a loser. He's dragging us down by being so weird. We have a lot of other people in our party who can talk about border security without being so nutty and without having these kind of authoritarian aspects. Since he won, you know, winners tend to prosper. People are going to try to copy him, whether they can or can't.
What do you make of the failure on the part of Democrats and the Biden administration to deal with the immigration problem at the border, which was so obviously politically disastrous? I mean, even if you had no other concern about it, the optics of it were so terrible politically that you'd think they would have been incentivized to deal with it for that reason alone. Why did it take so long to even address it? And what do you make of the, you know, essentially conspiracy theories coming from the right, coming from people like mm-hmm. Elon Musk and acolytes, that all of this porous border is a conscious plan to essentially seed the population with people who are more likely to vote Democrat, right? So it's right. They're trying to game our democracy. Now, this is somewhat belied by the fact that we're also noticing that Hispanics were not reliably voting Democrat in this election. But leaving that aside, do you think it was ever a conscious plan on the part of Democrats to leave a completely unsecure border because it would be politically advantageous to them?
I really don't. I mean, for one thing, if this was a political ploy to gain votes, it worked terribly because people really hated it. And it specifically moved Hispanic voters against them who were there dealing in the border community. You know, I think this is one of these things where I understand why people sort of want to infer malicious intent, but the truth is much more boringly incompetent, you know, that you have a kind of asylum system that exists in law. It's been on the books for a long, long time. And lawyers started advising people on how to exploit it, how to turn loopholes into it. It became completely out of control, a huge kind of problem. But Democrats did not want to, you know, buck the kind of legal framework, right? I mean, it's very proceduralist. They're very invested in this idea that, you know, we have a kind of a sacred right to asylum. We can only address this in ways that make sure everybody's sort of process rights are taken care of. Once Greg Abbott, you know, the kind of political coup of our time was Greg Abbott saying, look, I'm going to send people on buses to New York and to Chicago, and then you're going to see what it's like to deal with the kind of downstream chaos this is causing. And it immediately generated very ferocious political counter-response in very liberal cities. The Biden administration was terribly slow about making all kinds of decisions. You know, you follow the reporting on this, and there's stories from month six of the administration, where the president, you know, is like screaming at his aides and he's saying, like, what's going on here? What are we doing here? But he didn't do a good job of, you know, being organized, making decisions, making choices. I remember way back in 2019, I was talking to some people who had worked at a very senior level in the Obama administration. And I asked them, why aren't you supporting Joe Biden for president? Like, I would think that you guys would be, you know, behind the former vice president. And they told me something that's haunted me, honestly, for years at this point. They said that when he was vice president, whenever he was given something to be in charge of, he ran very disorganized, very undisciplined processes, that it was really hard to, like, bring meetings to an end on time, to make decisions, things like that. These are sort of dumb managerial failings that a lot of people have, but that you can't have in the president of the United States. And especially as I think we all know, he was getting older and seemed like he was spending fewer hours on the job than he should have been. And it's quite bad. What's striking about the immigration thing in particular, though, is that as soon as they decided that they needed to act on this more decisively, some of which was formal border security, and a lot of it was actually diplomacy with Mexico, it worked quite well, you know, and there was no need to have dragged this out for so many years. This is the kind of thing where I am optimistic that we can make rapid progress in the Democratic Party, though, that we really had a person who, in light of his age and his disposition and his lack of strong executive experience, was just not able to run a good process and to make good decisions, even when his inclinations were kind of in the right direction, you know? And I think almost anyone who's serving as a governor today, if you put them in the White House, would just not allow those kind of political vulnerabilities to mount. I mean, it's just a basic question of self-preservation. It's baffling that it was allowed to linger for that long.
I continue to be baffled by it because I don't see how it was serving anyone's interests for any period of time. So, for instance, you could be as liberal as you want about immigration. You could want tenfold the amount of immigration that we currently have, but it seems to me you would still want to let the people in who you actually want in the country, right? So I've never detected an argument for an open border or for a state of chaos at the border wherein millions of people come in and we don't know who they are, right?
It's worse than an open border because, you know, what happens is you're there, right? And you say you want to make an asylum petition. You pass the credible fear screening, you know, or you don't. But if you do, then you're kind of given a number and you wait for years. But you don't have legal permission to work in the right. United States, which doesn't mean people don't work. You know, they do. They work under the table, et cetera. But if you're thinking about, you know, a doctor or a trained engineer, right? These are people who can't work under the table.
Yeah.
Right? So if you had a truly open border, then all kinds of people could come in, including people with great skills who would be of great benefit to the country. When you have this kind of gray market in labor, right, you're negatively selecting people, right? You're keeping out the people who, in some ways, you kind of most want to bring in. There was a great piece in The Atlantic today. It was written by Frank Sherry and Cecilia Munoz, and those are veterans of progressive immigration reform. You know, they ran, one of them ran Unidos, and one of them ran American Voice. And, you know, they were saying, like, we gotta bring it back to reality, that there was this sharp turn, you know, against enforcement of all kinds, right? I mean, we talked about the Perry case, right? But just a kind of collapse of a belief in law and order among left-wing Democrats.
So basically, law and order is racist because its strictures are disproportionately visited upon Black and brown people. Is that essentially the argument?
Yeah, and certainly, you know, immigration, et cetera. And, you know, it's just been a disaster. It's been a rolling disaster. And you saw backlash to defund the police, and you saw now, more recently, backlash to this asylum situation. You know, I think the question of, like, actually what should asylum law say is somewhat complicated. But, you know, you got to get to something. We had a bipartisan deal on the table belatedly that Trump killed because he didn't want to sort of let Democrats solve the problem after they'd let it fester. I kind of hope something like that will get done. You know, immigration ultimately, I think, should be an enormous source of benefit to the United States of America, right? It speaks well of us as a country that so many people want to come here. Historically, it's been one of our strengths. If you look at the strength of Silicon Valley, right? I mean, a lot of it is American companies built by Americans. But an enormous amount of it is that foreign talent, you know, wants to come work here. And that's true, you know, in less glamorous ways. I mean, the people who take care of kids and clean houses and wash dishes in restaurants, I mean, all these people are contributing to our society. And I don't like, you know, anti-immigrant politics, anti-immigrant demagoguery. But, you know, obviously people would like to see an organized process, and you need to give it to them. And that has to take priority over, you know, what immigration lawyers want to say about asylum.
What do you think about the prospects that Trump is going to attempt to deport millions of people? Do you think that stands a chance of happening?
I mean, you know, it's a tough one, right? I mean, he's going to start by saying, you know, we need to go harder at deporting people who get arrested, you know, which seems reasonable. That's a good place to start. You know, I think if we go back to kicking down doors and deporting people who are working in meatpacking plants, who are picking vegetables, other kinds of things like that, it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough on the economy. And I, you know, sometimes people are like, oh, you know, we need the workers. And I don't, we could get by without them. But, you know, people have been very concerned about grocery prices. People don't like to see, you know, their neighbor sobbing because their husband, who wasn't harming anybody, just got deported. Mm-hmm. Like, that's sad. There's a reason why I think he didn't do that in his prior term. And it's just a question of, you know, does he want to be cautious and prudent, or does he want to say, you know, the gloves are off now? Because you could do it. You could divert the FBI away from, you know, like terrorism and the mafia, and put extra resources into trying to get like busboys kicked out of the country. But I don't think that would be a very good idea. It's not really what he did when he was president previously. So I have some belief that he's going to actually steer a more moderate course than he's said.
Hmm. Yeah, it seems on its face totally unworkable. I mean, to say nothing of just ethically abhorrent. I mean, when you think of the details of what it would take to actually carry through on this promise of deporting 10 million or 12 million or 20 million, whatever the number actually is, different numbers have been floated. But because in that case, you're talking about deporting people, again, maybe breaking up couples of the sort that you just described, but also deporting the parents of young children when those young children are citizens, right? I mean, just picture the optics of that.
I mean, that's a very tough one. It's also just a question of how do you do it, right? I mean, we don't have our citizenship like tattooed on our foreheads, right? You know, you look at things like, you know, the kind of bad experience I think this country had with the war on drugs over the years, right? The kind of invasions of privacy that are required in enforcing certain kinds of laws, right? Now, again, if you say, look, if somebody gets arrested for something, we're going to run a citizenship check. If he's here illegally, we're going to put him in a deportation proceeding. I mean, fine, right? Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. But, you know, how are you going to go around the streets of Houston or Chicago or Los Angeles and like finding the illegal immigrants? I mean, I don't walk around with my passport on me. You know, nobody wants to live in that kind of a society. And if somebody's here working, not hurting anybody, is that really what people want to see? I mean, vast sums of money put into removing millions of harmless people, I don't think is economically sound. I don't think it's morally sound. I don't think it's politically sound. I'm hoping he won't do it. But, you know, sometimes politicians follow through on their promises.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so final question before we jump into your 9 points. You said something that struck me as very interesting and counterintuitive in one of your recent blog posts about the populist backlash against institutions and elites, and in particular the media. And you argued that the media and experts generally are probably better than they've ever been, despite the fact that they seem worse. Can you flesh that argument out a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I was saying we're living in a more competitive environment than we used to be, right? I mean, if something really dumb gets said in a newspaper somewhere, we all hear about it. You know, when people mess up, we all hear about it. We have a much less controlled information environment than we used to. I think a lot of people have the impression that, you know, back in the good old days of the big three networks and one newspaper in town, you know, everything was fine, everything was perfect. I think the truth is that was more of a, you know, Noam Chomsky called it manufacturing consent. There was so little competition in the media space, there was no way to know, right, if you were being misinformed. And you know, Michael Crichton had this idea of Gell-Mann amnesia, which is, you know, you see a story about a field that you know a lot about, and you're just like, they're not getting it quite right. But then you forget that that's true of their coverage of everything. Now I think we constantly have our noses rubbed in the kind of shortcomings of mainstream coverage, or we even blow up the kind of the worst articles because that goes viral, right? No article has ever gone viral for sort of dutifully recounting the events at a local school board meeting, right? That's very boring. So our attention is kind of sucked up by everybody's miscues, everybody's screw-ups, things like that. And there's a lot of evidence that, you know, negativity kind of sells, you know, media-wise. So, you know, my argument basically was there were, of course, lots and lots of failures of the kind of national elites during COVID, during George Floyd protests. A lot of things went wrong. But when you look at history objectively, bad things are always happening. You know, there's a lot of bad conventional wisdom over the years. There's a lot of errors. There's a lot of miscues all the time. And I don't think it's really true that it's gotten worse. We've had some extraordinary successes in recent years, you know, some incredible biomedical advances, for example, in vaccines and these GLP-1 agonists. And, you know, we underrate that kind of stuff because we live in a very negativity-oriented culture. And it's something that I try, you know, not even in a partisan political spirit, right? But just to help people try to be like, have like happier, better lives, to think less about everybody's complaints and negativity about everything in the world.
And do you attribute this mostly to social media at this point?
Yeah, I mean, it's social media and it's the inherent competitiveness of the internet, right? I mean, how do you sell anything in a very competitive environment? It's by talking down everyone else, right? And saying, you know, you got to only listen to me, right? Everyone else is lying to you. It's all really bad. And social media in particular, though, is just an incredible machine for making people angry. You know, that's how it works. That's how you get attention on there. It drives pile-ons. It drives very extreme behavior. It supercharged a kind of extreme left for a while. It supercharged a populist right for a while. And I think it's a hard question. Like, how do we rebuild a kind of rational, calm, consensus worldview? You know, I like this show a lot. You know, there's a lot of good things in the media ether, in which people are trying to do a good job of being intelligent, having thoughtful conversations, things like that. But it does not naturally grow in this kind of social algorithmic environment.
All right. Well, let's talk about the psychic surgery that has to be done on democratic politics, which you did on your blog. Again, I recommend people read it. You went on at some length, but you also boiled it down to a list of 9 principles. The first one, economic self-interest for the working class includes both robust economic growth and a robust social safety net. That sounds straightforwardly rational. Why would that be controversial at all?
Very simple. I think it's not that controversial, but you have some efforts, I would say, to deride just this kind of basic virtues of growth and a safety net in favor of efforts to like bring back central planning or to say that being like really hard-edged anti-business is the way to go. I think in terms of, you know, the stuff you're interested in, it seems really basic. It seems really simple. Like we want to have a prosperous country and we want to, you know, make sure that we're taking care of everybody.
I'm quite worried about wealth inequality. I think it is you know, both morally untenable, but politically dangerous and certainly in the limit. But I'm also worried about stigmatizing wealth in the way that many leading lights of progressive thinking do. I mean, you have somebody like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, both of whom I think have said explicitly that the only way to become a billionaire is to essentially perpetrate some fraud on the American people, right? I mean, like there is no morally conscionable way to amass great wealth. And that just seems to, there's some version of anti-capitalism or Marxism or something being smuggled in there, but it ignores the fact that we have a system wherein creating immense value at scale for people is naturally remunerative. I mean, that is what capitalism is.
Yeah,
what's wrong with that? I mean, if you are committed to if you're committed to a social safety net wherein the wealthier we get, we now have the political wherewithal to spread the wealth around, so that all good tides raise all boats, and you know even the poorest person in our society, 50 years from now, has more wealth effectively than you know Louis XIV or beyond, or even a rich person today. what would be wrong with that? I mean, there seems to be an argument that you're tilting at here, which it goes against this notion. It's almost like the, you know, the tall poppy problem, right? I mean, it's just a, any yeah. inequality is morally suspect.
Right, or just an idea that any kind of large fortune must have been assembled through nefarious means or something that's not. Look, I mean, the richest people in America today are the founders of successful companies. And that's good, right? I mean, that is how it should be, right? It speaks well of us, I think, that these are not, you know, the heirs to other people's fortunes. You start a company, it has a product, it's very successful. It means your company becomes very valuable. It's an interesting fact about how computers and software work that they've been able to create a level of scale at Google or Facebook that was not imaginable before in the past. But there's nothing wrong with that. Then we need to make sure that we have economic institutions in place that mean that people are having their material needs taken care of. And we can do that. I think this effort, you know, there was a slogan a few years ago that somebody started that said, you know, every billionaire is a policy failure. And I don't think that's true at all. Billionaires are the result mostly of success in legitimate businesses, and that's fine. We have a progressive income tax, which is good. We have maybe some loopholes in that tax system that we should try to address.
Yeah. But I mean, Warren Buffett's observation that it makes no sense that he pays less in taxes than his assistant, right? And then if you look at the fact that some of these super wealthy people have no income to tax, and therefore it becomes inscrutable how to actually tax
Absolutely.
Them, you know?
So, you know, I think it's pretty simple, right? And you don't need to go into a kind of hard tilt anti-capitalist mindset to say, you know, we've got to have an economy that works for everybody.
All right, principle two, the government should prioritize maintaining functional public systems and spaces over tolerating antisocial behavior. This brings us back to a subway car.
To Penny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I mean, we talked a lot about the racial angle there, but, you know, the basic fact is you have murderers and other kinds of violent criminals who I think almost everybody is like, okay, that's bad. But we also just shouldn't, you know, all kinds of low-level disorder that's happening all over the place. It's important to have, you know, subways be good to ride on. That's the purpose of it. Last Christmas, I spent in Los Angeles, where some of my wife's family lives, and we were staying in a, you know, Airbnb rental downtown. And, you know, LA is a great city, but the atmosphere on the streets in downtown Los Angeles mm-hmm. is really alarming.
Yeah.
Or at least it was 12 months ago. Just a volume of people who seem mentally disturbed, addicted to drugs, kind of acting out, being left alone. And, you know, nobody assaulted me during the week that I was staying there, which is great. But it made the city seem like not a nice place, you know, and parks are full of people's tents. Like that's not what a park is for, you know, yeah. And we have to have public services. I mean, especially if you care about low-income people, people who are struggling economically, those are the people who need the library to be a good place to read a book. They need the park to be a good place to take your kids to play. They need the subway system to be a good way to get around town. And it's just a real breach of faith with people to say that, well, we need to tolerate disorder and low-level crime.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's such an obvious point, but it cuts against the intuitions that I've detected in many fellow Democrats, which is that it's an infringement upon people's right to live out the chaos of their lives on the sidewalk right in front of you, right? Like anything that's intrusive there, anything that limits a person's freedom to be wherever they want in a park or on the sidewalk, you know, however disordered they might be personally, that is a kind of it's coming from a spirit of entitlement and gentrification and white privilege and mm-hmm. disconnection to the suffering of others that should be castigated, right? I mean, like mm-hmm. Of course you want a nice park, Whitey, but mm-hmm. you know, you don't you understand that these people have just as much right to be there as you do? There's something so ill-conceived about that intuition. I mean, the fact that you can't detect a social cost in normal people of whatever class feeling unsafe to walk down a stretch of sidewalk and having to cross the street because there's people playing out the most visible forms of social dysfunction, you know, right there in front of the Starbucks they were trying to get into. It's just, it's hard to price that social cost, but it's just as obvious that there is one.
Absolutely. And that's why I think the question of, you know, who is expressing privilege when they say something like that is important for everyone to think about more strongly. Because, of course, you know, if you're a rich person, you could just opt out of this kind of stuff,
yeah.
Right? You just go live in a different neighborhood. Or, you know, you take your kids to the Sky Zone instead of the park. You know, you pay $50 and they can go bounce on trampolines. You know, I've done that with my son. It's people who are struggling, who need the, I mean, everybody benefits from like good public services and good public spaces, but it's people who are struggling themselves, but who are not drug addicts or mentally ill, who most need these kinds of things to function. And it's why, I mean, it's not a coincidence that it was actually in cities that you saw the strongest swing toward Trump.
Right.
Because it's, you know, and particularly in Black, Hispanic, and especially Asian neighborhoods, because those are the people who have been most harmed by this kind of collapse of urban order and sort of basic public space functioning. So, you know, it's such a serious problem, but also, I think, such a no-brainer to come back around.
All right, principle three. Climate change and pollution more broadly is a reality to manage, not a hard limit to obey. What do you mean by that?
I mean, I think your listeners probably know this, but, you know, there's people out there who are saying, you know, like the world's going to end because of climate change, right? They're like all of humanity is going to go extinct. And that's not true. It's a serious issue. You know, there is real downside to burning fossil fuels. It is good to try to find ways to get by with less of it. The progress that's been made in solar and wind power over the past several decades is really impressive. It's really important. It would be good to explore further alternative energies in the advanced nuclear space and geothermal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there's no need to be telling people that we're like on the precipice of humanity going extinct. And mm-hmm. It's bad economics for the United States of America. And it's really bad economics in the global context, you know, that you have so many problems in Africa, in South Asia, in parts of Central America, where people would really benefit from more economic development. And that is almost certainly going to mean more fossil fuel usage. And climate change is a genuine, in life, there's a lot of things that are beneficial on net, but they also have some downsides. And that's, I think, the basic situation with industrial activity around fossil fuels. Hopefully, as we make more and more progress, we can, you know, eliminate those trade-offs, mitigate the damage without going, you know, kind of over the cliff on it.
Yeah, I also think that focusing on clean air is a better strategy. I mean, it's just as a mm-hmm. proxy for minimizing climate change, because I mean, climate change, really for everyone, most of the time is still this, it's such a slow-moving object that it remains more or less hypothetical, whereas bad air in cities is so, and its health consequences is so obvious that I think you could fight that battle and solve the climate crisis, you know, with that as a proxy.
Yeah, and air quality is in some ways, I think, an underrated issue, continues to be. And to some extent, I mean, this has to do with attitudes toward the natural gas industry, because when you generate electricity with natural gas, the air quality improvement relative to coal is enormous, but the carbon dioxide improvement relative to coal, it's small. It's not zero, but it's small. So from my standpoint, to the extent that we can keep replacing coal with gas globally, that's a huge win. It's a huge win for public health. It's a small win for climate change.
Right.
But that's because the air pollution issue is very, very, very important. And I think something that should be talked about, you know, more.
Yeah, it kills millions of people still.
Absolutely. And it's a big indoor issue as well, particularly in poor countries.
Okay, principle four. We should, in fact, judge people by the content of their character rather than by the color of their skin. Rejecting discrimination and racial profiling without embracing views that elevate anyone's identity groups over their individuality. Now, we've obviously covered some of this.
Yeah, we've been talking about this a lot. And, you know, and I think we're very much aligned on this. You know, you want to discourage people from thinking in tribal, racial, ethnic terms and see each other as individuals, as fellow citizens, et cetera. And there are racists and there's racism in American society and in the world, but the left in America has started to really just overdo it. Like wildly oversell the idea that we need to be thinking about race all the time.
Mm. I guess I have a caveat I would add around the concept of profiling, because what we mean by profiling in some cases, perhaps not every case, but in some cases, is just nothing more than a statistical understanding of the demographics of certain types of crime, right? And there are situations where it could go either way, right? It doesn't always point toward Black and brown people, right? I mean, there's types of crime where your bias would be, okay, this is probably a white guy who committed this crime. And if that's part of a valid statistical analysis of just probabilistically how you're going to find the suspect, or even in the extreme case where the suspect's race has actually been identified by witnesses, right? Well, then, you know, obviously, if you know you're looking for a Black guy, if you know you're looking for a 7-foot-tall, redheaded guy, right, you shouldn't pretend otherwise, right? So that is profiling.
Sure, I mean, I'll grant you that on that level. Here's what I had in mind. So one thing that we know has been very effective when done is that when cities crack down on turnstile jumpers, right, people dodging fares, committing other kinds of sort of low level but very easy to detect crimes, you can stop them and then you can search them, and you often find concealed firearms. You find that they have outstanding warrants, things like that. It's a good law enforcement technique. Bill Bratton used very successfully in New York and then again in Los Angeles. It's making a comeback here in D.C. You know, statistically speaking, in Washington, D.C., it's about half white, half Black. The vast majority of the illegally concealed handguns in the city are being carried by Black men. But I think that if you're going to say we're going to have a crackdown on people who are jumping the turnstiles in the metro, we're going to stop everybody, we're going to search them for guns, we're going to run the warrants, you got to do that if you catch me doing it. You got to do it if you catch a woman doing it. Even though, like, we know, right, and this will be the next one, is about sex and gender. I mean, very little violent crime is being committed by women. That's the way the world works. Yep. That's the way humanity works. You've got to have neutral laws that you are enforcing in a fair, even-handed way. It's fine to, like, we're people, like we understand how the world works and some inferences, things like that. But like we're entitled to be treated as equals by the government.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, but the example of the difference between men and women is kind of the reductio ad absurdum of this whole thing. Like, obviously, you know, for certain types of murders any murder, but certainly certain types, you know, you're looking for a guy rather than a gal when you're looking for suspects. And that's priced in, and no one ever remarks on how it's a symptom of misandry, and we should pretend to be, you know, open-minded, looking for petite young girls who might have.
Yeah. Look, if there's a shooting on the street corner, it's almost certainly a man who did it, and we know that.
Right, right. So, but I mean, I'm brought back to one refreshing piece of honesty that I remember coming out of Jesse Jackson, to the amazement of many people left of center. I think he was addressing a almost exclusively Black audience. And he said, and this is probably back in the 80s, he said, you know, you know what I'm sick of? I'm sick of walking at night on the streets. I think he was referencing DC, hearing footsteps behind me, feeling a jolt of adrenaline, turning around and seeing that the person behind me is white and feeling and breathing a sigh of relief.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like that. Coming from a white guy, that's just pure, you know, racism, you know, David Duke style racism, or would be perceived as such. But coming from Jesse Jackson, given the fact that in reality, and this is still true to my knowledge, but it's been, you know, it has definitely been true for almost as long as we've been alive, that something like 50% of violent crime in America is the result of what something like 6 or 7% of the population does, and that 6 or 7% are Black men, young Black men, right? So that's the fact that the statistics around violent crime are so out of whack with respect to this identifiable characteristic gives people a background sense of, okay, there's certain circumstances where you know, you shouldn't be able to place a rational bet on the racial identity of the perpetrator until you found them. But you know, you have something like even odds that the perpetrator is Black in America. And you shouldn't know that because there's, you know, only 14% of society is Black, and, you know, and half of that is are Black men. So,
well, I mean, my key point, right, I mean, running this in the other direction, right, is that we can't say, we have to get away from the idea that enforcing the law is bad if what happens when you enforce the law is that disproportionately Black men are the ones who get arrested. It's true that that's what happens. But it is also true that, you know, African Americans are disproportionately likely to be victims of crime.
Yeah, yeah.
For some of these same reasons. And I think, you know, to the point, I mean, you were quoting Reverend Jackson on, right? I mean, this is a big problem in Black neighborhoods. And it's one that, you know, it benefits from having rigorous law enforcement and not getting too hung up on disproportionality, that we have to judge, you know, right from wrong and do the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, the best gloss on this that I've heard, and I think it's, I haven't heard it debunked, but the idea is that the Black community, especially in the inner cities, doesn't suffer from too much policing. It suffers from bad policing. There's over-policing of petty crime, and there's under-policing of murders, right? So there are lots of people get away with murder, and yet you have these ridiculous incidents of, like, you know, like the, I guess it was Eric Garner who, you know, was, they attempted to arrest him and they wound up killing him for, you know, selling cigarettes.
Cigarettes,
you know, right?
Yeah.
So it's that kind of thing that is so outrageous and horrifying. And that, it's moments like that where you get this indelible sense that, all right, there's unfair and racistly motivated police attention directed on disproportionately on young Black men. But the reality is that what's happening in a lot of these communities are murders are going unsolved. And the victims of living in that kind of environment are, as you say, disproportionately Black.
Yeah. And I thought about that when this healthcare CEO was murdered, which, you know, of course was terrible. And I'm glad that they tried so hard to catch the shooter. The fact is most murder victims would not receive that level of consideration. You know, there would not be, we have finite resources, et cetera. But, you know, if somebody in your family is killed just because he's not the executive at an important company, you would still want the police to try to catch the person. I think that's something that everybody, you know, is entitled to, that kind of protection of the law.
Yeah. Although, I would code this as a class thing more than as a race thing.
You know, no, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think this is 100%. And, you know, look, he's an important business executive. It's sort of how the world works, but it's not something we need to find admirable.
Right. Okay. Principle 5, race is a social construct, but biological sex is not. Policy must acknowledge that reality and uphold people's basic freedom to live as they choose. Drill down on that for me.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this has become such a toxic subject of discussion on the internet. But look, I think it is great that people feel more freedom to express gender identity in different ways than they used to. And that if people want to, you know, style their hair or change their name or whatever they want to do, how they dress, it's great. It's great. It's great. And, you know, we should have political values that are grounded in freedom and respect. People are entitled to believe all kinds of things about themselves and about the world that I disagree with. And that's very, very common. But, you know, there are men and there are women. The sort of facts about chromosomes and sex gametes and stuff are like very fundamental aspects of biology that we have to acknowledge and that we have to keep in mind, right? I mean, you can have all kinds of, you know, we get these controversies about trans people and using bathrooms, right? And it strikes me as a little bit immaterial. There are lots of, you know, ways you can solve for that and kind of fudge it. But then you have these questions about who plays on which sports teams, where it's completely antithetical to the concept of a women's sports league to be having people opt into it on the basis of selective gender identity.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the first thing to acknowledge on this topic is that it really is complex. Right. It's like it's not we talk about the trans phenomenon and gender dysphoria and kind of the political footprint this has. as though it were a single object, but there really are, they're just different cases, right? And there's a spectrum of cases where my ethical intuitions get pushed around very differently. If you're talking about an adult who has decided that this change of identity is warranted and desirable, and that this is what they want to have surgery and they want to be called by a new name, et cetera, that is one thing entirely. If you're talking about a kid who, from the earliest opportunity, declares that he or she is in the wrong body and never wavers from that, and early on wants help and never wavers from that. Again, that is a different from the first case, but also a kind of a clearer case. But then there are all these cases where the role played by something like social contagion is pretty obvious, especially among young girls and teen girls going in the direction of identifying as non-binary or declaring that they're boys. And there, it's a totally different phenomenon. And to lump this all up under the rubric of you have to affirm gender identity at the earliest opportunity, and anything less than that is an unconscionable breach of parental responsibility in the case of kids, or social graces in the case of adults. It's confused and confusing, and it's very easy to see why you take it to special cases where, like in competitive sports, where there's just obviously a zero-sum conflict between the rights of women and the rights of or desires of trans women in those cases. And it's what you're confronted with are trade-offs and probabilities, not clear, bright lines in many cases about what to do.
I think that's exactly right.
All right. I'll take that as agreement. Principle 6. Academic and nonprofit work does not occupy a unique position of virtue relative to private business or any other jobs.
Yeah, I mean, this is one is related to sort of anti-capitalist sentiment that we saw before. And, I was struck there was this controversy a couple years ago where left-wing people were criticizing Gina Raimondo, the commerce secretary. They said, well, she was doing too many meetings with CEOs. That's her job. Mm. She's the commerce secretary. She's got to do this stuff. I think if anything, the Biden White House was too reluctant to sort of engage with American business people, to hire people who have business experience into the administration, because, there's a lot of great professors out there. There's a lot of great academics. There's a lot of institutional problems in academia as well. There's a lot of conflicts of interest that exist out there. There's nobody who is 100% pure or devoid of these kinds of things. But we've got to have a government. We got to work with all kinds of different people. And we need to show openness. And like the Democratic Party is not supposed to be like a communist party, Yeah. And I think it isn't. But we'll sometimes take on these overtures of like we are just completely against business or capitalism, or want to hold at an arm's length the idea of a private sector economy. And it's not, realistic. You and I, we're not like titans of industry, right? But we're just here working, running little businesses, trying to make money, do things, create products that people like, mutual exchange. Like, that's great. That's what life is about.
Yeah, there's also a strange animus toward wealth that underwrites people's intuitions about it, just how the nonprofit space should function. So, for instance, when you look at the CEO compensation among nonprofits, if it gets too high, people think, okay, well, that's clearly unethical, right? You should, because that money should be going to the cause, right? It shouldn't be going to the CEO. But what's wrong with that is that then you're recruiting people who are given a forced choice. Like, do I want to, the most talented people have to decide, do I want to become truly wealthy and work for Goldman Sachs and, sell my soul to an industry that I actually think is at best, not doing anything especially good, at worst, evil? Or do I work for a nonprofit and not live the life of affluence that I actually still want, right? So that forced choice, you're kind of selecting for sainthood, perhaps, in that case. But it's anchored to a strange set of intuitions. It's like, if someone's going to do, most people think that there's nothing wrong with getting rich if you're creating, amazing music that millions of people want to listen to. So everyone wants to buy your CD or stream your music, or go to your concerts. You're now, you're Taylor Swift, and you're making a ton of money because people love your music. Most people think there's nothing wrong with that. But if someone was going to personally make Taylor Swift level money because they cured cancer, there's something indecent about that, right? If you're doing an obvious good, you shouldn't benefit in some outsized way from having done that good. You should have done it just for the goodness of that good on some level. And that just seems like the wrong system of incentives. If you really care about the most talented people spending all of their time, their full careers, just trying to solve the most galling social problems or to produce the most goods that can't be, you know, easily monetized by a market, you know, we should want to attract those people, and we should want the best people to be, you know, fighting to the front of the line to get those jobs.
Yeah, I mean, you got to pay for things that are important, and also acknowledge, to your point, that, you know, oftentimes solutions to big problems do kind of emerge from private industry, right? I mean, you know,
right.
When you had COVID vaccine development, you know, those are like companies did it, and you know, we've gotten a lot out of commercialized science and technology over the years. And that's good, right? And if there's a problem with Goldman Sachs, right, or some other things in the financial sector, it's because some of that seems to be like purely zero sum, right? Like people just trading against each other. Mm. But, you know, so much of what happens out there, you know, it's like people make money through mutually beneficial exchanges. And that can be good. And we sometimes may need to pay people a lot of money to do something if there isn't a kind of a private market for it. It's okay for people to be, you know, I mean, I think we should encourage people to be like high-minded and generous. But, you know, there's a self-interest in life, and that's fine.
All right. Number 7, politeness is a virtue, but obsessive language policing alienates most people and degrades the quality of our thinking. I don't know who you're talking about now. Who polices language? Does that ever happen on left of center?
No, never. Yeah, you know, I mean, look, I mean, this has been in the backdrop of a lot of what we've been talking about today. There's a time and a place for different kinds of statements and dialogues and persistence. You know, you were very involved in New Atheism, right? And, you know, that's the kind of thing that I go back and forth on to some extent, right? I mean, I wouldn't want to go to the church around the corner from my house on like a Sunday morning and start like yelling at the people as they come out, be like, guys, like this is wrong. Like, you know, this whole Jesus thing, yes. That's not true.
In our defense, Dawkins, Dennett, Hitchens, and I never did precisely
no,
that.
No, I mean, exactly, so exactly.
We were invited into the churches to tell them that they were wrong. And that was civil.
To write a book, yeah. Right? I mean, saying what you think, making important points, even though it's going to hurt some people's feelings, that's like what we are, I don't know, like that's what intellectual life has to be about, right? I mean, we can't make progress on big topics unless we can discuss ideas that are a little bit touchy. And there's a difference between, you know, there's a problem we have with social media, right? There's a difference between what behavior would be appropriate at a dinner party, right? That's socializing, and what behavior would be appropriate in an intellectual debate, I think.
Right.
And in social media, it's like we're often doing both at the same time, or confusing different things, or then trying to impose a real kind of ideological discipline on people to say, you can't say that, you can't say that, you have to use these words, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It came out of, you know, progressive activists, I think mostly on college campuses, started to spread out onto social media, into the media. And, you know, it's people just really hate it. And it is antithetical to like the life of the mind and intellectual progress.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the problem with social media and I guess spread beyond is just how people behave online generally and in certain parts of media now is we behave in ways, we're incentivized to behave in ways that we would never behave at a dinner party or on a debate stage, right? I agree with you that the formal debate or the, you know, what you'll say at a lectern to advance certain ideas is quite different from what you may or may not say at a dinner party. I mean, it's incumbent upon you to be rigorously honest when you're in front of a microphone trying to talk about important ideas. Whereas at a dinner party, there's absolutely a role for picking your battles and ignoring the idiocy coming in, you know, across the table at you from your uncle, just in the interest of civility, right? It's just a different occasion socially. But what's happening online now is, you know, I find, and this is one reason why I got off Twitter, I found people who I knew what they were like at both at a dinner party and in the green room and on stage, just behaving in this third mode online, which was effectively psychopathic, right? I mean, they were behaving in ways which, I mean, the formula really became, they would attribute to you the worst conceivable and sometimes inconceivable views that they could, that could be made to stick. And then they would kind of smear you with that for the delectation of their audience. And they were incentivized to do that because that's what their tribe wanted. But at a dinner party, they would never resist you clarifying your point or even in the context of a formal debate on stage, they wouldn't resist you clarifying your point. But on Twitter, it was impossible to clarify your point if you're being misunderstood because you were being willfully misunderstood and smeared.
And then nobody will chime in, right?
Right.
Because it's once the snowball has started going down the mountain, everybody knows. It's like, well, you know, I don't want to get in the way of this thing, right? I mean,
right.
Half the people will pile on, and the people who know it's wrong, the best you can hope is that they won't join the pile on.
Right.
Right. Nobody is going to say like, hey, wait a minute, guys, like let's extend some rigor to our thoughts and our analysis. And, you know, I mean, this kind of speech policing is upstream of a lot of the kind of specific pathologies that we've been talking about otherwise. I mean, if you want to know how, you know, people came to accept the idea that we need to let just disorder and chaos run rampant in streets and parks, it's because people were afraid of getting called racist. Not even that they thought it would be racist, but that somebody would say that it was, and then other people wouldn't stand up for them, right? And it's like, it's just chaos, and you need to be able to have real discussions of ideas around, you know, I mean, all kinds of things, but including things that touch on race and gender and sexuality and these kind of personal identity hot buttons of the left.
Okay, where are we here? We are at 8. Public services and institutions like schools deserve adequate funding, and they must prioritize the interests of their users, not their workforce or abstract ideological projects. What are you thinking about there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking, you know, especially about public schools and teachers' unions, although to an extent also police forces and the cop unions there and other kinds of public services. I mean, you know, every center-left political party in the world faces some version of this dilemma, right? You're the political party that believes that we should have public services and that we need to invest money in educating kids. So naturally, you become the party that teachers want to vote for, which is good. But you can become a party that is captured by them, right? And so now you're not running a school for the sake of the kids. You're running a school for the sake of the teachers who are in it. And that can be very bad. That can be very dysfunctional. We saw it with the sort of COVID shutdowns of schools. You see it with, you know, nitty-gritty stuff about the compensation schemes that are at work there, all kinds of things like that. And there's been a tendency, I think, in recent years for the teacher community to start pushing a lot of sort of questionable ideological ideas around race, around all kinds of different things as an alternative to doing what people want them to do, which is just like teach people how to read.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Finally, 9. And this brings us back to the border, perhaps other places as well. All people have equal moral worth, but democratic self-government requires that the American government prioritize the interests of American citizens. Beyond immigration, what are you thinking about there?
I mean, you know, this is relevant to a lot of different things about, there's questions about climate, there's questions about trade. I mean, I think this has sort of been the crux of populist backlash politics is a belief that, you know, elites globally, right, in the modern world, we're more connected with our intellectual peers around the world than we've ever been in the past, right? I mean, I live in a city, you live in, we all live in particular places, but our community can be much more abstract than it used to be, which is great in a lot of ways. I mean, I derive incredible value from being able to dialogue with people who live in Germany, live in England, live in Japan, live in Taiwan, et cetera. But it's since that a lot of people have, that a kind of international elite community has turned its back on the specific countries that we live in, and that immigration and border control is a particularly kind of vivid instantiation of that. Mm. But that, you know, I think most of what Trump says about trade is just wrong. Like, it's factually wrong, and he doesn't know what he's talking about. But it feeds off the suspicion that the people running the country may not really care about the country and about their fellow citizens. And I think the border situation, you know, is a clearer illustration of that, where I feel bad for people who would like, I mean, my ancestors, your ancestors, I'm sure, almost everyone in this country had ancestors at some point who moved here because they wanted a better life for themselves and their descendants. And I think it's the most understandable thing in the world. It's just also true that the decisions about who is let in have to be made primarily with reference to what's good for American citizens. And that's like how a democracy has to work. You know, if you can't commit to that, I think it's going to be very hard to ask other people to trust you with governing power.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think as a rider to that, I would add that one of the things that is good for us is to both feel compassion and be motivated by that compassion to help people who are in desperate need of help, right? So it doesn't close the door. If you wanted to be narrowly selfish, that still doesn't close the door to a very generous response to refugees really in need of salvation, because what kind of people do we want to be? What kind of culture do we want to be?
Well, and you know, I want to say in my personal life, I mean, I try to be more internationally minded, more humanitarian. I've been running on my blog a fundraiser for Give Directly, mm-hmm. which does sort of cash transfers to people in Rwanda. You know, I think it's very important to try to cultivate more elevated mindset, you know, in myself, in my family, and other people in the world. I don't think that America wants to be or should be a country that is, you know, like mean-spirited or just crassly indifferent to other people out there around the world. But, you know, particularly if we're talking about electoral politics, you do need people who are willing to say, like, if push comes to shove,
yeah.
right? Like, I am going to, if border communities need a more orderly process here, like, I'm going to make sure that I get that done and deal what I can with refugees as a kind of a secondary matter. I mean, this is, I put it last on my list, frankly, because it's the point I'm least personally comfortable with. You know, some of this, I'm like, you know what? You know, the voters, they got it right. Here, it's like, I'm torn. You know, I saw a guy walking down the street with a t-shirt that said, veterans before refugees on it. And I'm like, that's like a kind of an ugly sentiment.
Mm.
You know, like, I don't think it makes sense to like counterpose some kind of zero-sum competition between like healthcare for veterans and letting refugees come to the United States. And it makes me wonder like what he's thinking about or how he thinks the world works or why he would put those things in tension on his t-shirt. At the same time, I mean, I get it that obviously, you know, we care about our political system needs to care about our citizens and, you know, people who engage in service to the country more than it cares about foreigners. And that's the nature of self-government. But, you know, it's a tough one, I think, for people who want to be philosophically rigorous, but also practical in our kind of engagement with the political system.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the piece that you can't leave out is we want people in this country ultimately who will add value to the country. I mean, that sounds starkly, you know, transactional and selfish mm-hmm. when stated that way, but that's the only thing that's rational to want. We don't want people that will degrade our quality of life here, that will fight for values that are antithetical to the values that we think are important, right? I mean, we don't want to subvert the American dream in the act of, you know, thinking we're extending it to other people. So we want people who share our values. So to touch one of my hobby horses for a second, yes, we don't want any more jihadists in the West generally. I mean, not just America. Mm-hmm. It's like, insofar as you could build a jihadist detector, you would want it, and you'd want to be able to point it at people coming across the border and say, no, you're not coming in, because the jihadist detector just went off. But that should be uncontroversial. You know, I mean, that's just like, we want people ultimately who will share our values and improve our society in all kinds of ways that, you know, in the limit we could, you know, we could only dream of.
Right. And I think, how do I put this? You know, it's a contested space, right? Because of course we don't have a jihadist detector,
yeah.
You know, and it's not 100% transparent who does and doesn't share our values, but it's a reasonable yeah. concern. And I think it's something that, you know, you need to be willing to acknowledge, right? I mean, there's a kind of pure logistical aspects of immigration, purely economic aspects. And there are people who are excessively averse to kind of cultural change and, you know, diversity, things like that. I mean, there was a time when, you know, people were very upset about Jews immigrating to the United States and that it was going to undermine the Christian nature of the country. And I'm glad that, you know, ultimately didn't sort of carry the day. At the same time, like, there have always been efforts to keep political subversives out of the country. And there's a strong logic to that, right? I mean, you want America to be, you know, a strong and prosperous and successful society. And immigration has always played, I think, an important role in that. I think it's part of one of our national virtues, you know, is to have more of an open access political system, more of an open access value system. People can find, you know, I had a great time when I went to Portugal. It seemed like a lovely country. But I can't say I like understand what the Portuguese dream is, mm-hmm. right? Or that's something that people growing up all around the world might aspire to. It's just a nice beach to visit. America stands for certain things, which is good.
Yeah.
And it means that people can come here and sort of sign up and be a part of it, which I think we really need to celebrate. But it's perfectly reasonable to wonder if the people who want to come here, you know, do in fact affiliate with those values that the country stands for.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Matt, great to connect with you here. Thank you for your time and for all of the clarity you bring to our political conversation. I mean, remind people where they can find you online.
Sure. I'm at slowboring.com as my blog and newsletter. You can also find me at Matt Iglesias on Twitter. I'm still there in the cesspools duking it out with everybody. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah. Keep it up, Matt.
Thanks.